I remember years ago on my drive to work, there was a house that someone started to build and apparently ran out of money because he got the frame up. It was a two-story house, so we had a two-story frame sitting on a concrete pad for, I think, was a number of years. I don't know to this day if the thing ever did get finished. But I always thought of that passage where Jesus says, you know, count the cost. Otherwise, when you start to build and then don't finish, and I always thought of that as kind of a real life example of that scenario that he's discussing there. And really what you're looking at is that house only got so far and then it stopped. There was no growth after that. And I want to think about us as Christians, you know, that we need to count the costs and recognize that our level of personal commitment needs to rise with the level of expected responsibility. And that's an important point to make there, that our commitment level, we know where God says we need to be responsible to, but we need to raise up our commitment level to meet that responsibility. That's when we grow, is right there, when we start recognizing that those two levels need to be at the same point there. And if we don't do that, well, then that results in zero growth and decline. And it's as well for Christians as it is for congregations. We have a certain level of responsibility, and what we're asking ourselves now in the process of this series and this new year and just our hopefully collective resolve to go forward is that we recognize what that responsibility is that we have. Now we're raising up our commitment level to meet that responsibility. And we will grow if that is the case. It's not a matter of us being unable, because this is the Lord's work. And if we're living for the Lord and doing the right things for the right reason and in the right manner, the things of the Lord and for the Lord, then we will grow. The Lord guarantees that. You have to believe that. And of course, you need to also believe that if we resist in that, well, then we're not going to grow as a group, especially. So in Luke 14, that reading that Joseph read for us there, Jesus is speaking bluntly about what discipleship costs. It is not cheap, it is not convenient, it is not easy. Never has been, never will be. And he says, in essence, that the failure to finish after having committed really is worse than never having begun at all. Because that implies not only a refusal to engage in God's work, but also a forfeiture of what God promised in the first place, and all because of that person's unbelief. We see Jesus prodding people, you know, to really follow after him and finish that course. Even in Revelation 3, verse 2, he says to the church at Sardis, I have not found your deeds completed in the sight of my God. Keep in mind, he's talking to a church and not just to an individual there. So what would he say about us? What would he say about this group here? Would he say, well done? And keep doing this, what you're doing? Or would he say, I have not yet found your deeds completed as a church in the sight of my God? 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 10 through 12, Paul admonishes the Corinthians that you promised to give some money to this relief effort, and yet you haven't finished it. Now I need you to finish what you started. Fulfill your commitment to those people that you promised it to, and really to yourselves and to your God. So Jesus may be saying this to you or to me or to us this morning. Finish what you started. I'm not saying that in a matter of accusation here. I'm not sure of all what you did start necessarily. But I do know this. Anyone who is a Christian started something in Christ. And I do know this too, that anyone who's a member of this congregation, who has come on board as a member, you started something. You started something with us. And now what we're asking you is to help all of us, yourself included, bring that to its completion, whatever that is. And that's where we're at this morning. But beyond what it costs us to be disciples, there's another facet of costs, and that is the risk that we assume in, shall we say, doing business. I'm not saying this is a business. I'm saying that we do have a business to attend to, however. Following Christ requires taking necessary risks. Not everything we do or that is done to us is guaranteed to protect us from harm or loss. We know the final outcome. We're going to be well taken care of. You might say Christianity has an excellent retirement plan, okay, in that respect. But you cannot know, and you are not guaranteed, all the details in between, that is, up until that ultimate retirement there. And I'm not talking here about taking foolish or careless risks. Why would God ever endorse that? But the risks that we take are risks that we take in faith and in love. And I'll talk more about that in this lesson. This applies not only individually, but also collectively. So discipleship, which we've understood as our mission as a congregation, is discipleship. Well, then that is not a risk-free venture. There is no money-back guarantee if you're not completely satisfied, because you're not going to be completely satisfied here in the here and now. You will be satisfied, however, when you see it through, and you will be with God. All right, so that's our lead into our lesson this morning. Now we want to just start out by saying life is uncertain. That should not be a surprise to you. If you're on this planet for any amount of time, you should already know that. But you don't have any choice in the matter because you're here. You're alive. You didn't ask to be alive, but now you are. And since you're alive, you are stuck with whatever uncertainties, challenges, discomforts, etc., that life brings to the table. All right, that's one aspect, but discipleship is something different because no one twisted your arm to become a disciple of Christ. No one ever does. And if they are doing that, well, they don't have any right to. And you don't have any right to have to succumb to that. You have a choice to become Jesus' disciple. You don't have to do it. It is a voluntary endeavor. It always has been. It always will be. That's what we preach. This is voluntary. You being here this morning is voluntary, to the extent that you didn't have to do it. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a commitment involved in your decision to be here. I'm just simply looking at the big picture perspective. The reason why you're here ultimately came down to is because you chose to be. And what this means, then, is by voluntarily accepting to be a Christian, you also accept the risks, the hazards, the consequences which come naturally with such a confession. This is called intentional risks or active risks rather than passive risks. Okay? Passive, as you see on the screen, is what happens to you because you're a Christian and because of what you believe that you didn't directly enact because of something you did, but just because of who you are, your identity. But active risks is because you did something, and because you did that one thing, then that leads to a certain reaction there. Okay? So to appreciate and accept this gives proper perspective to what we're doing. And sometimes Christians don't have that perspective. It's one reason why we're giving this lesson. Some are baffled that they're enduring difficulties and hardships which non-believers don't have to deal with. Well, what did you expect? You engaged into a lifestyle and committed to a lifestyle that is far different than what non-believers commit to. So it's going to carry some extra responsibilities and yes, some dangers, if you will, and risks with that. Or some are confused why Christianity is so demanding and costly and things don't always turn out the way that we want to. But you're not in it for yourself. Remember why we're here and what we're doing is all for Christ. It's not for you. It's not for me. So we need to have that big picture perspective. Or some are upset and irritated that they receive toward their good intentions or the criticism for their good works. Has anyone ever been criticized for doing something good here? Oh, seriously? I'm the only one? Okay, a few other honest people. That's what I'm talking about, is that when you do good things, then the critics come out, right? In fact, I'm going to even say, be so bold as to say, the more good you do, the more you'll be criticized overall. That's just the way it is. And I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying that's the way it is, okay? So there are some who even abandon the faith because they don't understand this big scenario that we're talking about. There is a risk in walking by faith, but we are indeed to walk by faith. 2 Corinthians 5:7, Paul says, we do not walk by sight, but by faith. So risk must be taken into account. When we're counting the costs, and that includes everyone who counts that cost, we need to understand the risk factor here. So consider some different realms of risk. Obviously, there is a risk of loss. Jesus even says that. Luke 14, verse 33, he says, so then none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his possessions. Really, in that context, meaning does not regard all his possessions as already lost. for the sake of choosing Christ. You have to consider that everything you own, even though you presently have it and are able to enjoy it, that's a bonus. But for the sake of Christ, if necessary, you would choose Christ over all your things. It's really what he is saying there. And honestly, that may happen. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying that in the course of your Christian walk, that may happen. Early Christians faced ostracism, which meant that they could not get jobs. They were closed out of certain job guilds and out from society and family. They faced imprisonment. They faced confiscation simply because they were Christians. And you've got to understand, you've got to be keeping your eyes wide open that the way the world is going today, that we may be facing similar struggles in the future. Even as I speak, this is happening elsewhere. So far, we have been spared of this in this country, but nonetheless, we need to have the right attitude toward these things. Loss does not necessarily mean just physical loss of possessions and material wealth. It also can include status, the loss of privileges, the loss of opportunities and freedom, security, the loss of friends, the loss of family ties. It could be anything. It could be everything. In Luke 14, 26, Jesus says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, fill in the blank, anyone else in your life." In other words, if you do not choose Christ above every other relationship that you have in this life, then he says you cannot be, not it won't work out so well, but you cannot be his disciple. Well, that's a pretty strong commitment level. Consider all relationships then, even to your own self, as lost for the cause of Christ. There is that transcendent purpose that we need to have as Christians, not looking downward at this world, but looking upward at Christ. Well, there's also the risk of persecution. Mild persecution is inevitable if you're living the Christian life, and yet that may get more intense as time goes on. As I said, Christians today are among the most assaulted and persecuted minority groups in the world. And that is true across the world. Those who are keeping statistics recognize that Christians, not other minorities, not other religions, but Christians are being targeted in the world more so than any other group of people. The tide of law and public sympathy in this country is shifting. Deviants and criminals and false religions have more protection than do Christians in many respects, and that is going in that direction. We have been called bigots in the past because we do not endorse all the religions out there as being equally valid, and yet the real bigotry is against Christians themselves because we are being hated without a cause, just as Jesus was. Matthew chapter 5, verse 10 and 11, Jesus says that if you're persecuted for the sake of righteousness and because of me, well, then you are blessed. I want to stress here that not all persecution and not everyone who is persecuted is being persecuted for the sake of righteousness, which means for the right reason, and not even for the sake of Christ. So just because you're persecuted doesn't mean that you're blessed by God and that God has favor with you. You need to be persecuted for the right reason, because of what you're standing for is true, and then for the right person, because it's for Christ and not yourself. So if that is true and you are persecuted, Jesus says, well, then you are blessed and God will take care of you. In fact, Jesus makes no apology here. Instead, in Matthew 5:44, he says, pray for your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. I don't think the other religions in the world are doing that for those who persecute them. Do you? But we are told by our master and by our teacher and by the one that we admire, we are being told to pray for our enemies, not to shoot them, not to kill them, not to behead them, but rather to pray for them. Why can't the world see that this is a much more noble perspective than what is going on in the rest of the world? In other words, what Jesus is really saying is know ahead of time that persecution will come and know your proper response to that persecution. Paul says in 2 Timothy 3:12 that everyone who lives godly will be persecuted. That's his statement. I believe it. I hope that you do too. And then there's a general abuse. Everything else funnels into this one right here, just the risk of abuse. This is similar to persecution, but not as organized or systematic. And that includes just the ridicule, the mockery, the slander that you endure for being a Christian. Realize that people often ridicule what they're afraid of, and they want to distance themselves from you rather than to have to face you. They are, in essence, afraid of you and afraid of what you believe. But that fear comes out in the form of mockery, insults, all kinds of slanderous statements. But you are a threat to people who don't want to believe. Just think about that. It kind of turns the tables in a way. We're thinking, oh, we're afraid of those people. Oh, the reality is they should be afraid of us and are, and we should not be afraid. We should be bold and courageous, as we are told in Scripture over and over. Be strong, be courageous. Exploitation is another aspect of general abuse. Will be taken advantage of. Your time, your effort, your kindness, your goodness, your generosity, hospitality, your willingness to give without demanding repayment, your love, all of these things will be taken advantage of. I can guarantee that just by my 30 plus years as a Christian, my observation plus my own personal testimony is that all those things will indeed be taken advantage of. You will be exploited to some extent. And then the mistreatment in various forms through discrimination, perhaps denied a promotion or denied legal justice because of your faith, vandalism, property damage, misrepresentation, defamation of character, which again, I believe is all these things are going to get worse, not better, as time goes on. You need to prepare for that now and understand that your level of commitment needs to rise to the level of expected responsibility. My whole point with this is not to scare you half to death. I'm glad several of you did not go running out of the building screaming, and that would be awkward. But nonetheless, my whole point here is not to terrify us to the point of inaction, but quite the opposite, that you should know up front what is expected. We're trying to be realistic here, not fearful. We're told in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus says to the disciples, which he sends out to the cities in Jerusalem, and he tells them there in that passage that you see on the screen, if they maligned the master, then they most certainly will his servants. Yet Jesus never said, it's too much risk to send you guys out. Better let me handle everything. You guys just sit on your church pews and let me take care of this. Notice he never said that. And there's reason why he never said that, because that's not in our best interest, for one. And then secondly, the gospel needs to be propagated, not just by one man, but by many people. What he does say, in essence, is know the risks, take necessary precautions, but believe in my Father's ability to take care of you no matter what. And three times in that section alone, he says, do not fear. This is something I need to hear often, and you probably do too. Do not fear. Fear is an improper response to the risks that are involved. It indicates a lack of personal conviction. It indicates a lack of personal faith. Fear causes more harm than whatever risks we face will cause. Think about that. It's fear that will do us in before the external threats will. It's our fear that we need to get rid of, not the external threats, because we can't get rid of those, but we can minimize our fear to the point where our faith well overshadows it. I'm not saying you'll never be afraid at all, and I don't think Jesus is saying that. What he's saying is you cannot afford to be controlled by fear, but controlled by faith instead. Notice that Jesus also never said, in order to be safe, you need to keep to yourselves and be wary of everything, because there's some inherent problems with that, too. The safe course always implies, fear. Jesus never promised us that we would be safe here, but rather that our souls would be secure with God. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 18, Paul says, "The Lord will deliver me from every evil deed and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom." Now, I don't know if you know what Paul went through. Well, maybe you do. If you've read the book of Acts and Corinthians and so on, you understand that Paul went through a lot. And yet, this is the last extant letter that we have, which means the last surviving record we have of Paul's writing, and this is what he's saying. "The Lord will deliver me, will bring me safely to his kingdom." So was God's promise to Paul, and so is his promise to us. Despite all the risks that we're going to face and have faced so far, this is what he says to us. The question to you and me is, do we believe it? Do you believe it? But to always take the safe route because we're afraid of risk, there's absolutely no biblical support for that. Jesus didn't do it. Paul didn't do it. We don't see any of the disciples or apostles doing that. Now, if I can take a little sidebar here, my observation, and this is just my observation, you don't have to agree with it, but my observation, having known this congregation for quite some time, having been involved in this congregation, not consecutively, but since 1988, I think I have a fair view of what's going on here. And I can say this, historically, this congregation has taken a relatively safe, and I will say even overly cautious approach to nearly everything that we do, bordering on almost a paranoid and neurotic fear that if we do anything too different or outright radical, then we will suddenly be drowned in a flood of liberalism. And some of this is propagated or, really kept alive by some of the older generation. I'm not placing all of this on them, but the older generation that went through the institutional debates and those crises and things like that, and you became guarded and jaded because of that. Not only that, but then you've got my age group that was on the heels of that, and we were taught a certain way, and so we became guarded and jaded. Let me say this. We need to be very, very aware of the dangers involved of doing what we're doing. And we would be well advised to be that wary. But we cannot act in love and wisdom if we are paralyzed in every direction we look by the fear that if we do that, something bad could possibly happen or make us uncomfortable or change what we're doing presently. Let's just stay where we're at. We can't be there and at the same time be saying, but we want to grow as a congregation, because those two agendas are not compatible. They are in conflict with each other. So we need to make a decision. We're either going to go forward or we're going to stay still. And if we stay still, I'm telling you quite candidly here that our time is limited as a congregation. It's not a matter of if we will die. It's just a matter of when. So we need to make a decision. We can stay still and keep everything the way it is and comfortable and everyone feeling good about that for that respect, the safe route. Or we can realize that there's more to do and there's other ways of doing it, better ways of doing it, challenge ourselves, challenge our thinking, move forward and grow as a congregation and keep this group here alive perpetually. That is not my decision to make. That is our decision to make. But I'm telling you candidly, and mark my words, that if this congregation says, I don't want to grow, then what in the world am I doing here? That's not a threat. That's just a matter of where I have to be. I cannot in good conscience stand before a congregation that refuses to move forward. And you shouldn't be a part of a congregation that refuses to move forward. Just think about what we're saying here. We're not dancing around the issue. I'm coming straight out and telling you, we've got to grow to survive. We have to grow to survive. It is not enough for me to grow or you to grow personally. We also need to grow collectively, which is why we're talking about this so straightforwardly this morning. You can't ask God for a risk-free, danger-free, harmless, crossless life that violates the terms and conditions of our relationship with God, the terms and conditions of our discipleship to Christ. We cannot always be so conservative in our efforts to spread the gospel that nothing ever happens. We need to take advantage of the opportunities and seek different ways of meeting those opportunities, talk to different people than we've talked to in the past, be very liberal in sharing the gospel. We'll talk about this more as we go. It's true that you don't throw your pearls before the swine. I get that. I understand that. I believe that. But what that means is be discerning, use good judgment. But what it doesn't mean is don't withhold the gospel up front to people who you think aren't going to listen to it. Don't judge them unworthy before they even hear the message. What it means is when those people have deemed themselves unworthy by refusing that message, especially repeatedly, well, then turn to someone else. Don't waste your time with people who don't want to change, don't want to commit, don't want to obey. Being generous doesn't mean being foolish and careless. As disciples, we are in the business of promoting the word. We're in the business of proclaiming the excellencies of him who has called us. We are not in the business of being naive. We are not in the business of being gullible. We are not, hopefully, in the business of being oblivious to reality. So, failure to act in faith is really an act of unbelief. The righteous shall live by faith, not by fear, not by unbelief. We're asking ourselves this morning, what are we living by? What is it that's driving us? Congregations themselves face risks that are very similar to those of individuals, but only when they are active. You've heard this story before. Well, some of you have. Just bear with me because some of you haven't. So there is a true story about a preacher who went to visit and preach for a congregation there, and he's talking with the preacher of that congregation. And he's talking about, the difficulties that congregations face and sometimes the friction that congregations face as they do their business, if you will, and in engaging in growth and maturing and so on. And the preacher of that congregation where the other one was visiting says, oh, you don't have to worry about that. We have no friction here. And the other preacher was very observant of the situation and says, you're right, because you need moving parts for friction. I want you to think about that, that you need to have moving parts, and that those moving parts are going to create tension and friction and heat and conflict at times, but that's part of moving. That's part of growing. That's part of going forward. That's part of what we do, and that's part of what we should accept just up front here, if you will. So we're not asking for a frictionless future. A conflict-free opportunity. There will be friction. There will be friction among us. There will be friction from without. There will be friction all around the place so long as we are moving. Actually, friction is indicating that we are moving. In the positive sense, it shows that we are doing something. Hopefully, though, it is the right thing that we are doing. So we have to look at this then. When we invite perfect strangers into our homes for study or into our building for services, we are opening ourselves for risks. Giving people knowledge, information, and empowering them with a sense of involvement and participation, that brings risks with it. Because you don't know always what they're going to do. And I'm going to say, sometimes when we get our newer Christians and they finally get the chance to, for example, come up front or do something different, I'm always in the back of my mind going, I wonder what's going to happen now. Because I don't always know. I mean, we've taught them and they've been trained and they've been, sometimes given a script or whatever else, but that doesn't stop them from just kind of loose cannoning off into the distance there, and there's that risk there, and then we just have to deal with that if indeed that happens. I'm not giving you permission to make that happen. I'm just saying, if it happens, okay? For example, the last number of years, a very limited number of group of men have been involved with fulfilling the duties and responsibilities required in our actual assemblies here, partly because, I had to just say it, no one else has stepped up. So we've had a very finite group of men there, that as we grow and teach the gospel, that will change. And it will be uncomfortable, but it will be necessary. In fact, I think it will be good overall, but it will be uncomfortable. Another example, today's new member may literally and figuratively be tomorrow's class teacher, song leader, deacon, elder, possibly even preacher. We don't know what the future holds. It is unnerving in some ways and terribly exciting in others. I hope that you feel that. I hope that you sense that. I hope that you're aware of that. There's always the possibility of misuse and abuse. Someone may even take advantage of the situation, forcing us to confront them, those situations, that is. Conflicts may arise, forcing us to deal with them. This is uncomfortable. This is inconvenient. This is even a bit threatening to us. Furthermore, we may bring other people's problems into our group, which is really inevitable, threatening our safety, so-called safety, risking our complacent, comfortable lives. It seems to me sometimes we think that our problems are okay, but when someone else brings their problems, then it's not okay. So we need to get rid of this us and them kind of thinking is what I'm getting at here, okay? Like there's us, the core group at Kent, and then there's them, the new people coming in and starting to identify with us. There is only the us. That's the way it should be, okay? The only them that exists is them that are not yet us in the sense of part of this group. Once they become part of this group, there's only us. And that's really how we should look at this and treat one another with that attitude. The more active we are in evangelism, personally and collectively, the more likely that will cause work, the more likely that will disrupt our schedules, that will require extra time, extra patience, extra effort. It will jeopardize and disrupt our so-called status quo. I'm asking you, can you accept that up front? Are you committed to that? Because if you say, no, we don't want that as a group, well, then we're done here. And let's just say that. We're just done here. We're just going to be a status quo congregation. We don't want to change. We want to stay the way we are. And we're just going to die here. Just like that. The conflict of interest to maintain the status quo versus the desire to grow. That conflict of interest is only going to be removed when we realize that we don't have really two choices. I mean, yes, we have two choices in that we can choose one or the other, but the only one that's going to work for us is to grow. I've heard people always say, they come into our group and they say something like, oh, this is a small group. I like small congregations. And in the back of my mind, that kind of chafes at me. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, we are kind of small. I wish we were big. And in fact, we are not going to remain small. Hopefully, we're going to get bigger. Then what are you going to do? Go look for another small congregation? Or isn't that what we're supposed to be doing, is growing in size? Here's what I would like to do. I mean, this is just Chad talking, not the elders, not you, okay? Chad talking, is that I would like us to get so big that we have to, out of necessity, not because we're dividing over some petty little argument, but out of necessity, we would have to have a group of us go into another location in another city and start another work there and keep doing what we're doing. Keep growing here and now keep growing there. That's called multiplicity, okay? And that's called basically growing beyond this group. And I hope that you're looking in that direction as well. So this is going to take some things, though. If we're going to face these risks, we obviously have to pray to God. We call upon the one who is truly in control because we are not in control. We have our objective, and we know that. We're working toward that, but we can't control all the factors involved in meeting that objective. God can control all of that. We need to pray to him. Not just give him our petitions, but also give him our praise for when we see success happening. If we act in faith instead of fear, then we'll rely upon the Holy Spirit to guide us versus our own finite, limited abilities, and he will lead us. And in that trust, we can do what we can and what we must, and we leave the rest to him, confident that he will not fail us. And there's that faith in action there, not just talking about it, but actually practicing it. If it's up to ourselves, we might be very overly selective with who we share the gospel with, if anyone. We have lost sight of our purpose. But if we pray to God, help us grow, understand the necessary implications of that request. You can't say to God, help us grow, and yet excuse yourself from the work that needs to be done. Because you're part of the us, remember? And so when you pray, help us grow, then you're saying, and involve me in that, whatever you need me to do, God. You can't be asking things for this group that doesn't affect you personally. But think about that in a positive way, how it will personally affect you beneficially as well. It also requires love and wisdom. Discernment is really what we mean by wisdom there, as opposed to paralysis and paranoia. This is the proper disposition we take towards such risks. We need to have a sense of danger because it's real, and a sense of risk because that's prudent. That allows us to be alert and sober to what could go wrong. That's called being realistic. However, we cannot be so danger conscious so as to immobilize ourselves by fear, because that leads to a failure to explore and consider and attempt beyond whatever we're doing presently, and yet we're still claiming we want to grow. Or it leads to the criticism of anyone who suggests something different simply because it is different. And we have met that here in this congregation in the past, where someone's brought up something different and there was a backlash of criticism because it so seemed radical to what we were doing that it just couldn't even be considered. I'm not asking us to dive into liberalism and hope to protect ourselves. What I'm saying is that we need to grow and understand that there's risk involved. And yes, going into liberalism is part of that danger that we're facing. But that is not going to happen if we have competent leadership, if we are prayerful, if we are mindful of what we're doing and our objective, and if we stay with the Word. In other words, we have protection. And we need to exercise that protection. We're not acting in love if we're withholding love. Just think about that. We're not acting in love if we're withholding love. And we can't love without taking risks, because all manifestations of love are sacrificial in nature. There has to be a loss or sacrifice of some kind. Don't tell me you love me, but don't give anything to me, as far as of yourself, that is. If you're going to love me, then it's going to cost you something. And likewise, if I show my love to you, it's going to cost me something. And if we show our love to the world and to the lost, it's going to cost us something. And if we're going to show our love to one another, even that's going to cost us something. We just need to accept that up front. If we truly want to grow, and this has to be a collective decision, not a one-man campaign, then we, not me, not a few of us, but we together need to calculate the costs and the risks. And in doing so, we need to be practical, we need to be realistic, we need to, again, make sure that that level of commitment is rising to the level of expected responsibility. And someone says, well, there's an opening door to abuse there when we do that. Well, something can be abused, of course. But just because something can be abused doesn't mean it's not worth pursuing. Money can be abused. I don't see all of you getting rid of your money. In fact, we still collect money every Sunday and for the purpose of doing God's work. Can it be abused? Yes. But we don't stop earning it. We don't stop collecting it. Authority can and is abused, yet we understand that that is necessary if we're going to have stability, order, and productivity. Love can be abused. Marriage can be abused. Knowledge, grace, mercy, all of these things are open to risk. The gospel itself that God gives to us, He gave to us knowing full well that it can and will be abused. But He doesn't stop giving it. That should sink into our heads, that good things are worth pursuing. Excellent things are worth pursuing despite the risks, the dangers, and the hazards involved. That's what Jesus taught us. And yet with prayer and purpose, with love and wisdom, as we've discussed, we can govern a congregation in the same way that Jesus governed His life, by surrendering our will to the Father's will. That's what He did. That's what we can do. And that's what we should do, always. Being a congregation is risky business. It doesn't mean we have a license to be foolish and careless, but we're simply accepting there are things that are going to happen that we cannot control. And that this is what, at the heart of many Christians, what they fear is if we open up our congregation to include more people, then we are going to lose that control. And that paralyzes us to basically control issues. And if that's what we're doing, then we're not right in our discipleship. In fact, we have no right to be in the discipleship business if that's what we're so paralyzed by. In fact, we don't even have the right to be called a church of Christ. We should change our name to just say church, because then we are just a generic, nameless, unguided, misled group of people that will soon disappear anyway. God is asking us to do nothing different than what He's already done for us. He has taken risks. He has risked a lot just for you, just for you to hear His gospel. And you need to take some risks too for His sake, knowing that He's going to take care of you. If you're doing what is right and you're doing it for the name of Christ, He's going to take care of you. That's what we're going to say this morning. We've got more to say in the weeks to come. I won't be here next week, but Rich is going to give a lesson that's along this line, and then we'll pick up our series when I get back. If there's anyone who needs to come forward this morning, if you're prepared to accept those challenges of being a disciple, not only for the days to come, but for the rest of your life. If you're ready to do that, you're ready to become a Christian or ready to rededicate your Christian endeavor, well then do that this morning as we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected.